Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Urien Timmer, Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, is back for another Fidelity Connects podcast. In speaking with host Emily Ananuevo, Urien reflects on the data to understand what's happening currently in the financial markets and look beyond the news headlines. Urien looks at the impact of COVID-19 on global markets, what history tells us about past U.S. elections, and what to expect in the future, as well as opportunities and issues in today's markets. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets changes frequently. Today's podcast was recorded on October 22, 2020. So, do you find yourself wondering how rising debt levels are affecting today's investment decisions? Well, Fidelity portfolio managers David Wolf and David Talk's latest asset allocation paper, Debt is Fine Until It Isn't, is now available. The paper walks you through how David Wolf and David Talk are adjusting their active asset allocation strategies to address the consequences of today's debt-driven markets. You can read the paper at fidelity.ca under the Expert Insights section. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Urien, welcome. So happy to have you here today.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Emily. Great to be here.
Your job is to study the markets and produce insights for investors. But what exactly does your role entail as head of Global Macro? And how do you stay motivated day in and day out analyzing numbers and the markets?
Well, I mean, I consider myself as a resource both internally at Fidelity to our portfolio managers, as well as externally to our investors, our shareholders, our clients. And what I basically do is study history. I'm kind of a market nerd, if you will, studying past market cycles to see what we can learn from the past and how that fits into, you know, what's happening today. You know, market history is a subset of human behavior and human history. And so there's always something we can learn, even though history doesn't really necessarily repeat, but it certainly does rhyme, as an old saying goes. And, you know, this is such a three or four dimensional puzzle that we have to solve. It's almost impossible to solve it with perfect clarity, but it's certainly really challenging. And it's actually a lot of fun. It's very stimulating.
Absolutely. And I know you've been with Fidelity for over 20 years. So really looking forward to getting your insights today on all sorts of headlines and things moving the markets. So let's get into it. The second wave of COVID-19, obviously something that's on everybody's minds. But what is this second wave doing exactly to our economic cycle? And what should investors keep in mind as there's so much kind of fear and anxiety around the world right now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a very unusual year. We have a global pandemic. We had the first wave back in March, April. And now certainly certain parts of the world are seeing a second wave, mostly Europe, but also the US and Canada to a slightly lesser degree. And it seems to be a regional thing, at least in the US, where first it was sort of New York, you know, the Northeast, then it was the Sunbelt state, as we call them, and now it's the Midwest. And, you know, fortunately, the death rate, the hospitalization rate is way down from what we saw in the spring. But of course, it's a problem not only for for people, you know, everywhere, but also for the economy, because for the markets, this has all been about, okay, the economy is shutting down, at least it did back in the spring, and then it reopens. But when do we get back to kind of the old normal, if you will? And the way I like to think about this is, you know, at first, the COVID pandemic was seen as a form of natural disaster, but on a global scale, right? So the economy goes from 100% operational to, let's say, 10% as the economy essentially mostly shuts down. And the idea was initially, at least, and we just go back to 100%, just like it was an earthquake or a hurricane, but then on a much broader scale. And what we're seeing now is that COVID is being persistent enough that that scenario is only partly true, right? We went from 100 to maybe 10, back to, let's say, 70. And now the question is, when do we go from 70 to 100? Does that take 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years? Obviously, vaccines play a large role in that, as well as when we reach herd immunity. And so that's kind of the challenge right now. It's not that the economy hasn't bottomed and the market hasn't bottomed. That, I think that's all behind us, and things look good on that front. But how long does it take to close that final gap? And that's really a big question right now.
Yeah, huge question mark. And you mentioned the vaccine and the vaccine race. You know, we don't know when that's going to come out. How? But what are your thoughts in terms of the implications of a vaccine on the market?
From what I'm hearing from our own healthcare experts in terms of the healthcare sector, is that there is a lot of good momentum there. There won't be necessarily a vaccine that, you know, everyone takes and everyone is essentially cured, or it prevents them from ever having it. It'll be more of a series of vaccines and treatments. It'll be kind of like a cocktail of treatments, if you will, so that people with risk factors, whether it's age or comorbidity factors, can take that as a preventative measure, and either, you know, prevents them from getting it, or if they get it, will produce milder symptoms. And this is, I think, part of the reason why this second wave has proven to be less deadly already. I mean, certainly it's the younger people getting it who are less at risk, but also hospitals know much more about how to treat this, and therefore, you know, it's becoming a more manageable disease. And so our sense is that there will be a series of vaccines coming out. Probably in the first half of next year is when we will reach critical mass. And it looks like production will be very strong already right off the bat, like the pharmaceutical companies are all prepared to produce lots and lots of them. And so hopefully by the middle or end of next year, hopefully that this will be something that we can kind of put behind us, where it becomes still an issue for some, but a very treatable issue.
Okay, moving on to another major headline. Obviously, the U.S. election race, less than 2 weeks away, really feels like around the corner. Now, taking a note from the 2016 election, and this being 2020, of course, I think we should be prepared for any outcome. I think that's safe to say. So if the outcome is a red sweep or a blue wave or undecided, what would the implications be on the market for each scenario? I know that's a big question, but if you can sort of unpack each case, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so certainly right now the markets are, rightfully or wrongfully, you know, the markets are not always right, of course, but they are expecting a blue wave. And really, that's been the case since the first presidential debate. I think that was a few weeks ago. We're going to get the third or the second one tonight. And so the thinking is that the Democrats will take the White House, keep the House of Representatives, and also flip the Senate. So that would be a blue wave. That has obviously certain implications for the markets, for investors, in terms of taxation, regulation. But I think what the market is rightfully focusing on more than necessarily those two things is that we're likely to get very large scale fiscal stimulus, whether it's a Green New Deal or some version of that, infrastructure, education, and that there'll be a lot of government spending going on, which will create very large deficits. And I think what is very unique about this moment in history is that those large deficits will likely get absorbed by monetary policy. And that actually brings me back, again, as a history nerd, to the 1940s, which is the last time, I believe, or maybe the only time, where we saw very large deficits because the U.S. was entering World War II, of course, and those deficits were essentially monetized or absorbed by the Federal Reserve. And by absorbed, I mean the Federal Reserve basically bought the bonds that the Treasury Department issued to pay for the war. And at the same time, interest rates were kept at extremely low levels, about 1% at the time. And while inflation was going up, that allowed real interest rates to go negative. And that, when you're running a lot of debt or high deficits, negative real rates is a very effective offset. And so that's the blue wave scenario. I think that's what the market is focusing on. Ironically, a red sweep would produce a very similar outcome, because certainly the folks occupying the U.S. White House right now are not afraid of deficits either. You know, we were running a pretty big deficit even before COVID, and now, of course, it's even bigger. And that combination, I call it a fiscal monetary cocktail of fiscal expansion absorbed through very accommodative monetary policy, I think would be also seen in a red sweep, although you wouldn't see the taxation and the re-regulation angles of that. It would just be deficit spending and accommodative monetary policy. Ironically, the scenario that the markets usually cheer, which is a form of gridlock, especially one where there's a Democrat president with a divided Congress, normally that is actually the best case scenario for markets, because that's just the way the history it rolls out. And I think actually in this case, even though that would be maybe a fiscally more sustainable outcome over the long run, I think that would actually throw some cold water on the markets over the near term if we end up seeing the Democrats take over the White House, but the Senate remaining in Republican hands. So that's how I kind of frame the election as we head into November 3rd.
Urien, in the market meltdown in March, research shows investors were less likely to sell if they worked with an advisor. We know that advisors help investors think long-term, of course. We hear this all the time. So what does history tell us about investing for the long-term and staying disciplined?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and it's absolutely true. And I know this just from my own experience. Investing, it's interesting. On the surface, investing is just math, right? I mean, it's market history, it's probabilities. The stock market goes up 60, 70% of the time by an average of 10%. We know how diversification works. We're always trying to optimize the intersection of risk tolerance. How much risk are we willing to take so that we can sleep at night? Against our investment goals, right? We need to save for retirement, and so it's the intersection of those two skills that we need to manage. And that's basically, it's almost like an actuarial exercise. You can optimize it. You sit down with someone, you tell them what your assets are, what your risk profile is, what your goals are for retirement, how long you have until retirement, because a lot of this rests on the ability to compound returns over a long time, because the stock market can be volatile. There are obviously risks in place, and sometimes the market goes down 20, 30, 40%, like just happened in March, and it takes a while to come back. In this case, it came back very quickly, but other times it can take a few years, if not longer. So you need to manage your liquidity needs against your risk profile and your goals. But so all of that is well and good, and you can put that in a computer and it spits out an outcome. But then comes the hard part, which is to actually stick with that plan. When the markets go up, it's easy to stick to the plan. But when the market goes down, which always happens at some point, it's very tempting to just kind of take our marbles and go away. And this is where a financial advisor really comes in, because that is that person who can kind of talk you off the ledge, if you will, and say, no, this happens. And, I've done the numbers many times. The odds of a 10% correction happening at any time for any reason is about 40%. I mean, that's a pretty high number. So, 30% of the time, the market is going down, not up. And so we need to have that kind of discipline and detachment, emotional detachment, if you will, to ride those out. And a financial advisor can be exactly that right person to say, okay, this happens. Markets have recovered almost every time since it happened. And otherwise, we're just left to our own devices. And especially now, where everything is electronic, all you have to do is press a button and you're out. That can be a really difficult thing, because once you're out, you need to come back in at some point. And then if you haven't timed the market correctly, which most people can't do, I can't even do it, and I've been doing this for 35 years, then you've missed out on that compounding, right? The whole notion of compounding, even if it's little returns. If you compound returns long enough, you're going to get to your end goal. But if you get out and then get back in and you've missed 10, 20% of market returns, you're kind of back to square one and you have to start all over again. And when, you know, and that's one, it's one thing if you're 25 and you start over again, but if you're 40 or 50, you're really behind the curve at that point. And so, you know, very important to have someone to kind of keep you in check.
Absolutely right. I mean, nothing really can replace that, that connection, that relationship with a financial advisor, especially during these times right now. We are getting viewer questions in. I'd like to get to a few of them here about spending and currency. One viewer asking, with the US and Canada spending so much money, what might that do to the currency value?
You know, currencies are kind of the ground zero, for lack of a better term, of policy, both fiscal and monetary policy. So normally, if a country runs too much debt and that debt is owned by foreign investors, you know, if the country cannot prove to be fiscally sound, those foreign investors will bail on their debt, and then the currency goes down. I mean, that's your typical emerging market scenario, and we've seen that play out many, many times throughout history. But of course, the U.S. is a little different because the U.S. has the reserve currency of the world. About 62% of global foreign exchange reserves are in U.S. dollars. And of course, Canada and the U.S. are very closely tied as trading partners, et cetera. So Canada kind of, you know, plays along with that to some degree. But what's happening these days is that most countries are running too much debt. It's not just the U.S. and Canada. It's Europe, it's China, it's Japan. And so, and all countries have interest rates basically at or near zero. You know, the US was the exception, and Canada until about, you know, 6 months ago, and then rates plummeted here as well. And so at this point, with rates all being near zero and all of these major economic powers having massive debt overhangs, and I'm talking, you know, over 100% in terms of federal debt to GDP, but in terms of all debt, including consumer and corporate and financial debt, we're looking at, you know, three and a half times GDP across the board. When you're in that position, currency becomes the new frontier in terms of running policy. And what we're seeing right now is that the Fed, the Federal Reserve, has kind of the upper hand for the, you know, or the lower hand in terms of being able to win the race to the bottom. Again, it's a terrible place to be in, but this is why the U.S. dollar has been coming down in recent months, because again, we have this fiscal monetary cocktail right now in the U.S. of large deficit spending essentially being absorbed by the Fed. I mean, if you think about it, the U.S. government has run about $3 trillion in deficit spending this year, and the Fed has bought $3 trillion of bonds. I mean, they haven't bought them directly from the Fed, from the Treasury. They've bought them in the open markets. But you can see kind of one hand, you know, takes care of the other. And, you know, that's something that Europe has a tougher time doing because of the way Europe is constructed in terms of its fiscal authority. So the U.S. is sort of winning the race to the bottom right now. And again, you know, Canada and the U.S. are kind of tied at the hip in that sense. And so we can almost treat that as one large regional bloc.
Okay, another question coming in, this time about gold. We're obviously seeing lots of news about gold. Is this still a backstop for currency and uncertainty?
Yes, it is. And certainly gold has sprung to life in recent months. I mean, it did so already before that. And Bitcoin is joining the fray as well. Even silver has. And, you know, gold is a, I view it as a currency, as a hard currency, if you will, whereas the dollar, the yen, the euro, the Canadian dollar are fiat currencies. You know, they're paper currencies backed only by the full faith and credit of the country. And when you run large deficits and you let real rates go negative, as is happening, and that really is the key, the key distinction there. That tends to be very bullish for hard assets, for gold, including gold. And this is what we've seen in some points of history in the past. So when the central bank, the Federal Reserve, Bank of Canada, other central banks see inflation go up, and inflation isn't a problem yet in the U.S., but that's certainly a very large area of debate right now. And when you look at inflation protected bonds, they are pricing in a rise of inflation, and the Federal Reserve is already targeting kind of higher inflation. It's now doing what we call average inflation targeting, which means it's going to allow inflation to overshoot the 2% target. So when the central bank deliberately lets real interest rates go negative, that has been in the past very bullish for gold. And this is exactly what's happening right now. And again, borrowing from that 1940s playbook, if that is something that's going to repeat over the next 5 years, not in terms of the economic conditions, so obviously, hopefully not a war or anything like that, but in terms of running large deficits and then offsetting those through monetary policy, that should, in theory, increase the money supply, which would increase inflation. And then if the Fed leans against that by not raising rates, but by keeping rates very low, you're going to get negative real rates, and that should lift the price of gold, gold miners, silver, Bitcoin, basically real assets. It could even include real estate, for instance, or general commodities, or countries that are commodity-centric, which of course includes Canada.
As a comment that they're seeing this disconnect between markets and the economy, they're asking, is it unusual that markets have increased over the past several months when there's so much uncertainty out there right now?
Yeah, I mean, that I've been getting that question during this whole cycle, and especially earlier on back in, you know, April, May, June, when the market was recovering very sharply, but, you know, the world was still kind of falling apart around us, you know, people, more, you know, unemployment numbers going up, GDP falling 30% on an annualized basis, earnings still following. And so there were a lot of concerns about, you know, is Wall Street disconnected from Main Street? Is it all a bubble that the Fed is creating in the absence of any fundamental support? And the answer, my answer is it's partly true. So when you see a liquidity infusion, you know, again, as I was saying earlier about this cocktail, when you see liquidity being pumped into the system, and the excess liquidity, so the growth in the money supply relative to the growth in the economy, when that spikes, it tends to find its way into financial assets, so assets in general, basically. And so you see the valuation, the price to earnings ratio then spike. And that's exactly what we've seen. But there's another more scientific explanation, let's put it that way. And that is that the market always looks ahead, right? The market's always discounting. It doesn't always discount everything correctly, but it's always looking ahead. And normally when the markets are trending in one direction or the other, you don't really see what would be an apparent disconnect, but what really isn't, because the trend is going the same way. But when you are at an inflection point, either a top, but especially a bottom, markets tend to bottom like a V, you can see that disconnect. But really, all it is a timing mismatch, because at bottoms, the market will start to see the recovery, even though the recovery isn't happening yet, but it starts to price it in because it sees what the policy response is. It looks at the rate of change of indicators and et cetera. And so what will often happen is that the market will bottom about 6 months or two quarters earlier than the economy will bottom, including earnings and unemployment and things like that. And so during that 6 months, by definition, if you look at price and you look at earnings, and therefore the price to earnings ratio as the valuation metric, if price bottoms but earnings are still falling for a couple of quarters, by definition, the PE is going to go through the roof. And that's exactly what's happened this year. It's also exactly what happened back in 2009 following the financial crisis, right? The market bottomed in March of 2009, and earnings only bottomed in the third quarter of 2009. And by the time earnings bottomed, the market was up already 50%. Guess what? That's exactly what's happened this time around. So a lot of this apparent disconnect is really just a timing issue of markets always looking ahead and price always leading earnings, certainly at inflection points. And so a lot of this is really just benign and not evidence of a bubble. Although, as I said earlier, the liquidity infusion this time around is so massive that it has certainly found its way into the markets. And this is why the market is so focused on the fiscal response, not only in whether we have a blue wave or a red sweep, you know, starting next year, but even in the coming weeks in terms of the next tranche of fiscal relief, which is now being hotly debated in Washington.
A few minutes left in the show. I wanted to get to a few more questions. If you can actually look ahead to 2021, Jurjan, what are some key markers in the next year that will indicate that economies are improving?
Yeah, so it's back to what we discussed earlier. You know, if the economy went from 100% to 10% during the lockdown and is now back at 70, and those are not scientific numbers, I'm just using them to kind of paint a picture here. It's the clarity of when we go from 70 back to 100, right? And so the vaccines obviously play a very large role in that, but also this fiscal relief that the market is correctly very focused on, because the economy needs it, right? The longer it takes to fill that last 30 percentage points, the more of a bridge you need from the policymakers, both fiscal and monetarily, to get us to the other side. And that's the case in Canada, in the US, in Europe, Japan, everywhere. And so the two things that I think will really determine how quickly we recover and what 2021 will look like is the progress on vaccines and or herd immunity. I mean, we're far from herd immunity from the numbers that I've seen. Are the policymakers willing to keep building that fiscal bridge to the other side? I mean, certainly the pent-up demand is there. We all want to go back and get it, you know, and travel and go places and not have staycations. So I think the demand is there. The ability for consumers to spend is there because of these fiscal payments and the lack of options to actually spend our money. So the savings rate has gone through the roof. And so everything is there, but we need the economy to be open. And for that to happen, we need vaccines or herd immunity. And then while we're getting to that point, we need ongoing fiscal relief just to keep everyone whole, basically.
Jurjan, we've touched upon the value of advice, the importance of it throughout the show. You've been in the financial industry for many, many years. I'm curious to know, what is the best piece of investing advice you've received that you still carry with you today?
Absolutely. The best advice I've gotten, or the best thing I've learned, is actually not even investment advice. It's just the ability to detach. We need to have a plan. I mean, you can't invest without a plan. You need to know what you're doing. You need to know what you're getting into. You need to know the risk profile of different assets, the return profile. You need to be properly diversified. But again, all of that, it's not easy. Like, you need an advisor. You need to sit down with someone who has done all the work to get there. But it's doable, right? Everyone can do that with the right help. But then the hard part, and I think the most important part, as we discussed earlier, is just knowing that you've done the right thing to then let things just unfold with some level of emotional detachment. And so my mantra is always, I want to be fully engaged in the process, but also fully detached. And that's a very hard thing to do. It's a paradox, right? We're all human beings, and that's a hard thing to do. But to me, that is probably the most important thing that we as investors need to do. And of course, the third part is to rebalance, right? When you see large movements in the market, like we saw in the second quarter, you need to rebalance, because if you started with a 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, in February, that 60-40 was 60-40. A month later, in March, at the bottom, that 60-40 was 50-50. And then you need to rebalance, because otherwise, when the markets recover, the stock market will grow off of the 50 and not the 60, which is where, you know, presumably you have to be. So it's have a plan and then rebalance on a regular basis. If you can do those three things and start really early and put money to work every month for decades, I think you're going to do well.
Well, great mantra. I think the perfect way to end it right there. Jurjan, I want to thank you so much for your time today and sharing your insights with our audience. It really is a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.